stuff for me? And how was sorry, just to advance.
You've got a pointer here.
Okay, I don't need a pointer, I just do need to advance it.
Alright,
I got it, no advance from this?
No advance.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I love to talk about this topic, and I've been given about 40 minutes to speak. I have about 4 hours of material, so I hope you can follow as I speak as quickly as I can. As you know, risk, we define risk as surprises. If you know about something, there's not a risk, you just have to deal with it. And risk consists of both, as you've heard, opportunity, upside opportunity, and downside problems. I was just handed a recording device, I don't know if it's working, I have no way of testing it. The upside opportunity is that this will go on the record, for better or for worse. The downside is that now that I'm on tape, I can't give you any of the colorful stories from my many years of experience. I only put 30 years in my bio because when I tell people I've been working for 40 years, it scares them. They expect a much older looking guy, so it's actually about 40 years. I'm going to spend about 30 minutes rushing through this topic. I'm told you are a very, you know the topic and you're into this area, so I don't have to sort of explain what enterprise risk management is about, and I'm just going to give you the flavor of what we do. Because I'm hoping that by leaving some time at the end, we can get some dialogue and some good questions. I prefer doing questions and Q&A than just talking to PowerPoints because, you know, it's just a lot more fun. Did I press the wrong button? I have to retrain this risk manager ever so often. You have to press down. Okay, let's see if we can try that again. Okay. Just give a very brief background on Hydro One, why we got into it, the approach we developed, the challenges, something about our process, and some of the future things that we haven't tackled and might in the future, and some of the benefits. Very, very briefly, we are the company that takes electricity from the generating stations, whether it's nuclear, hydro, coal-fired, etc., to the municipalities where you live, if you're in a place like Toronto or Mississauga. If you're out in the country somewhere, we're also the people that bring the electricity right to your door. We have $11 billion worth of assets, $4 billion worth of annual revenue. We have about 4,000 employees, and every year we spend about $1 billion capital and maintenance to keep the lights on and to, poles, wires, transformers, and all the equipment. I just want to preface this. I have two titles and so forth. One is to do with internal audit, one is to do with risk. This topic has nothing to do with audit. Okay, we're talking about business, we're talking about risk, we're talking about risk management. It's nothing to do with Sarbanes-Oxley. It's not a how to meet Sarbanes-Oxley. It's nothing to do about compliance. It's nothing to do about audits, they've said, or regulations, or performance measurement, or credit market and operations risk, although the latter will come in. But when we talk about enterprise risk management, we're not talking as conventionally about credit risk, market risk, operational risk, and hoping somebody else is worrying about the rest of the stuff. We're talking about all risks together, and we depend not to distinguish between them. Because when a bad debt gets written off, it's very hard to figure out because credits are always good when you do them. You know, it's the guys back there that didn't collect the money. So we don't tend to distinguish in those categories. What it is about and the way that we practice it, it's all about good governance and good management. It's making sure that the board, management team, and the guys in the front line and women in the front line have agreed objectives and strategies throughout the organization. So it's talking about alignment of objectives. It's talking about looking into the future. And we tend to look 2, 3, 4 years out. It's looking at the prioritization of objectives, making sure that we're tackling the big topic. So we talk very much in terms of the top 10 risk in the company. And resource allocation, we spend $1 billion, about $900 million of that is based on a risk-based approach. And the final objective of not having any surprises. Why would you get into this as a company? And there's some companies that shouldn't get into it. It's not needed. The what I found through experience is that it depends on the degree of change. John Gardner here was at Sun Life. In the old days, in life insurance, there was almost no change. Year after year, life went on good. Okay, you could almost predict the results for the next year because those policies just kept cranking through it. It was a very, very stable business. You wouldn't have probably needed enterprise risk management in those days. The amount of change in senior management, if you have good succession planning and you don't have a new management team, you probably don't need it. And if you have a very, shall we say, hierarchical, dictatorial, whether benevolent or not, management, you probably don't need it as well. And if it doesn't, you don't have to explain your decision making. However, if you have a lot of change in your industry, change in senior management, and you want to be transparent in how you do things, then it can be a real benefit. Because it's a lot of team building, clarification of what you're trying to achieve. Some of the drivers very quickly, and I'm going to go over this because I assume it's kind of taken, but there was a lot of intellectual thinking about this back in the late 90s that got this whole thing going. Things like the day report in December 1994 for the Toronto Stock Exchange was the first articulation in Canada that said that directors are responsible for identifying risk in the organization and monitoring how it's being managed. The various scandals, you're all very familiar. I looked on your website, you've got a Barron's case study there that you're all familiar with. Sarbanes-Oxley has generated a lot more interest in it. The rating agencies now, S&P and Moody's, are doing very specific, because after they lost all the, their clients lost money on Enron and WorldCom, they said, hey, you gave us a good rating, how come we lost our money? So they have set up corporate governance methodologies that include looking at whether the companies have enterprise risk management in place and who does the chief risk officer report to? Does it to the board, is the CEO, etc. And they've got ways of now, so it drops to the bottom line, because if you don't meet their expectations for enterprise risk management, you could end up paying more for your cost of capital. Director colleges are now pushing this. Ed McMaster, Rotman, etc. This whole emphasis on risk management at a holistic level is being taught, and there's a lot of recent media attention. And finally, I don't know how many actuaries in the room, more than one? A couple? Okay. Last year, the Society of Actuaries put this topic, enterprise risk management, and their society taking a leadership in it as their number one strategic priority for their association. So you've got this room full of brilliant mathematicians who wish to take over this whole discipline, if you will. That's their strategic objective. Of course, the insurance guys are doing it, and the market risk guys are doing it, and they're all, talking a different language. So this is a great opportunity that we can share how we're each doing it. But there's a big drive on there from all of the associations to take over enterprise risk management. Just a couple of quotes here. And there's no point getting into panic about the risks of life until you have compared the risks which you worry with those that don't but perhaps should. And this is very true in a lot of the companies I've been in, the big banks, insurance companies, etc., who will go in, and Krung Life, I used to do the audit of Krung Life, and they calculated actuarial reserves to 17 decimal places with great pride. Except they were using outdated mortality tables, they were using 3% interest rate assumptions at a time we were paying 15% to borrow money back in the 70s. So you can get into too much detail, but you've got to look at the whole picture. Bunch of quotes here that I won't take your time to read, but some of them are very interesting. The middle one, for example, overly complex methods are likely never to be fully implemented. So when you're implementing something new, like enterprise risk management, if you get too complicated, you're not going to sell it to the rest of the company. It has to be something that people can understand and deal with. And that's why we use a lot of color coding, traffic lights, red, yellow, green, to get management's attention. Why we got into it? Back in 2000, there was a lot of change going on. We no longer had a government guarantee. We were supposed to be market opening. You know the whole story. You read about California. You read about Ontario. So there was a lot of pressing need to look at the risk in the business. There was a lot of change. A whole new management team. I was brought in. About half the management team was from outside of the company. Tremendous change. They brought in four different consulting firms to try and implement it before I arrived. And they would come in, they would do all these fancy risk maps and interview people and collect their fee and leave, and there was no transfer of knowledge. And then finally, the CFO came to me and asked if I would take it on, and I said, no, thanks, I'm doing audit, and it's a conflict of interest, and it should be somebody else. And then I said, let me think about it, and I figured, well, it could be fun, and B, it hasn't succeeded before, so why don't I take it on and give it a shot? And I said, if it doesn't work in 4 months, we'll turn these couple of staff I inherited over to become auditors, and we'll move on in life. So the theory is, or my position is, that enterprise risk management should not be part of audit. It should not report in the same lines. There should be a healthy tension between the two, assuming the company is big enough. So if you're in a big bank, insurance company, whatever, you know, more than 8,000 people or 5,000 people, you probably can afford to have two different positions. We're a small company. We have 4,000 employees, and I do it as a sort of a sideline. But when I my staff do not attend the same staff meetings, the audit staff cannot see what the risk management staff have done without the written permission of the line management. It's run as two separate product lines, and I think that's a good way to do it. You can't read that probably at this distance, and the only message I want to get across, because this I'll make available on however you want to distribute it, website or whatever, is to say that it's usually up to a four-year program. It's not something you're going to do and finish in 6 months. And this is an actual one I use in August 2000 as a status report to the management team, saying what we've done so far, what we were partially complete, and what we still had to do. So it's a you've got to have a plan if you're going to implement it and roll it out. It's not going to be a short-term thing. We have a policy. I just was involved in designing a survey for the Conference Board of Canada. It's just completed, issued in December 2005 on enterprise risk management. And in the appendix there, we published our policy. We have an umbrella policy for enterprise risk, and all other policies fall under that, interest rate, safety, whatever else, and this is the umbrella policy that speaks to enterprise risk management with the key principles and the accountabilities, who's responsible for what. In our case, the Audit and Finance Committee takes the accountability as opposed to the full board. And then we have a framework, which is really the procedure manual for how we do things. So that's just the policy is a two-page document. The framework is probably 7 or 8 or 9 pages as a how-to. Very briefly, the board, through the audit committee every year, approves the policy and framework. They did that this morning. I went to the audit committee this morning for the annual reapproval of our policy and framework. The executive management defines the risk tolerances, gets buy-in for them from the board level, and then uses them to manage risk downstream. Line management does risk profiles, usually through workshops, anonymous voting. We have anonymous voting equipment. At our full flight when we were implementing this, we were doing 40 or 50 workshops. If you've seen Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where you press your buttons and get the votes, that's what we use to get people in a room, experts, coming to a consensus as to how big a risk is, how probable, and how good the controls are and what you're going to do about it. Those profiles go up, and then part of my job is to report that. Think of it as a top 10 list of risks in the corporation to the Audit and Finance Committee of the board, and every couple of years I'm invited to present that to the full board. And we call it a top 10 risk, but sometimes it's 13, sometimes it's 9. It depends what happens. So that's kind of the high-level strategy. Some of the challenges, we had to redefine a lot of things. As an auditor background, we'd always heard about this thing called inherent risk. There was only one problem. I couldn't find it. The only inherent risk we could find was weather. Most other things, you cannot have it existing in the complete absence of controls. So you can think of an airplane crashing. But what would be an inherent risk for an airplane flying? I mean, you'd have to imagine a plane flying up there without gas, without a pilot, without aerodynamics, etc. So we found that when we were dealing with management, they couldn't get their head around something called inherent risk. So we had to define it as largest credible risk. What's the kind of worst that could happen if a whole series of controls failed? So we had to come up with our own definition there. We had to redefine controls because we were operating at too low a level. And we've kind of redefined controls where the ultimate control is where you've got very senior management involvement, when the CEO is involved. And that may only be in a crisis situation. Maybe Y2K or some major crisis going on. So we had to redefine controls. It's not being where some middle office guy is reconciling the trade and profit to the, you know, the blotters at the end of the day, but it's at a much more senior level than that. And we also got into risk trends. Is the risk getting higher or lower or et cetera? We use the word risk tolerance. It's not technically correct, because I'm sure when you redefine or define risk tolerances, you'll be talking in terms of the amount of risk you'll take on at a certain rate of return. We just use the term, and really it means impact. What is the largest impact that you could have? But if there was, and we'll get to it in more detail, but if this is probably the single most important thing we do in the company, and that is get an agreement between the board, senior management, and line management as to the tolerable amount of risk you'll take. How much loss of money, or how much in terms of environmental spills, or how much in terms of customer dissatisfaction is really, really bad, and how much is something you can live with. And getting that in a room full of people like this isn't an easy task, but it's a very healthy task, because without that, how are you going to manage a company? How are you going to have a hockey team where people can't agree on what the strategy is? Staffing, people say, what do you need to do enterprise risk management? And there are two personality types you need. One is you need a showman. You need somebody who's going to go out there and get people excited about it, and that's not me, by the way. You need somebody who's going to facilitate workshops, who's going to get people engaged, get people opening up their souls to them about what bothers them. And in fact, the last guy I had, and I know that Graham met him, his real love in life and his part-time job is a blues singer. And he loved being on stage, and he loved facilitating workshops. And the other personality type you need is an analyst, somebody who can do a lot of data mining, tumbling numbers, etc. And it really needs both of those to put it all together. Software selection. We use, as I say, anonymous voting. There are two main types out there. One is called Option Finder. The other is called Resolver. Both are pluses and minuses, both very popular and reliable, and that's what we use a lot in our workshops. And then the other question is, you collect a lot of data around the company of all the various risks, etc. How are you going to manage that? And we started looking at software. Anything in North America we found very, very expensive. We found a New Zealand company who allows you to take and roll up and aggregate all of the various risks across the company to help with our risk profile. So that's part of the challenges to do that. This is what we call risk tolerances. It's really just the impact of risk. And very briefly, this is just a model. Over on the left-hand side, we have about 10 or 12 key corporate objectives. What it is this company is trying to do. In this example, it's to do with financial, make it, net income, brand reputation, aligning the workforce, and safety. And these are the types of things that the board of directors sets as some of our targets. Then we take an event description, something that's easy to understand. You see, it'd be very easy to do this as a deviation from some sort of performance measure, that if you're plus or minus 2.6% of some sort of performance measure being a 5% increase, mathematicians would love that. The problem is you've got a room full of people, it's very hard to understand. So what we try and do is make it in little sound bites that are very easy for the whole management team and all of the line staff to understand. And on a scale of 5 to 1, we come up with a way of grading what we consider to be acceptable, non-acceptable loss or risk. In our company and in this model, a 1 or a 2 would be considered acceptable risk. A 3, 4, or 5 would be considered unacceptable and would have to be mitigated down to a 1 or a 2. And as you can see, it's not just financial. It's all areas of you know, whether it's safety, whether it's public relations, etc. In fact, this is an old one, because this was when we were going public and selling shares on Wall Street. We were very worried about international media not liking something we did. And so this was from back in 2001. But we found out after we canceled the IPO, we had a spill in Pickering, an oil spill, a transformer blew up and some oil got into the creek and started to head down towards the lake, and we had to rush and clean it up in a hurry. But we found very quickly that the province is what we have to worry about. It's you guys and ladies as taxpayers and people that live here. You're our customers via the government. So we don't really care anymore what happens on Wall Street or what they think of us. We've now, if you look at a current risk profile, the provincial profile is now worst case. If the Minister of Energy or Minister of Environment is unhappy with us, that's really, really bad. So that's how, as our objectives have changed from marketing internationally to just being a provincial company, our tolerance has also changed to reflect that. So over on is worst case on a 5, minor is a 1, something we can live with at the corporate level. And obviously when we then do this for a subsidiary or a division or a project, this is scaled down to the objectives of that division or that project. And there are numerous examples of that. When we go around and do a risk profile, and this is just entirely a model just to show how, in order to form an opinion on human resources, we will go around and we will gather all the information around risk on all the things that constitute human resources, some which will be, in this example, as in our company, we have some demographic problems. Our company, the average age of an employee is about 48 years old because it's a fairly static industry with a red, yellow, green. And then this will roll up maybe to, so when we go and do a risk profile, we can then go back down and say, here are all the things that give rise to that opinion. On any one of these slides or topics, I could happily spend 40 minutes, but I don't think we don't have the time for that. On the first page of the risk profile that I gave to the audit committee this morning, this is an old one, for purposely so, March 2001, December, we show the various sources of risk that we consider part of the top 10, and this would be 10 or 13 or whatever, the current rating that the senior management team has agreed on, the previous one, and the trend, whether it's going up or down. This is done based on all the workshops we've done. It's based on interviewing all the senior management team, 30 to 40 senior executives and experts. So we'll go out and talk to the environmental expert, etc. And we will formulate this. Behind each of these lines will be a half to a one-page write-up as to the sources of the risk, what business objectives it impacts, what's being done about it. And then we have a session with the leadership team where this will be kicked around and people will agree or disagree, etc. And then this then goes to the audit committee as well. But what you then have is a linkage between what the board knows, what management knows, and what line management knows. Sounds pretty obvious, sounds pretty logical. Doesn't every company do that? Does every company do that? Should every company do that? Well, as I understand it, it's probably 10 to 15% companies maximum that are currently doing that. But it sounds so logical. Moving on now to how we spend money. Should be of interest to some of you. In any particular area, we go through ahead of time for that particular risk and do some voting, using our anonymous voting, and say what would be considered an unacceptable risk. If this particular risk happens, and it happens more frequently than a certain amount, and we create a red zone for that particular risk. And this will help drive our economic decisions. So for every source of risk, we have a red zone. We then take all the work we have to do and carve it into packages. define different alternative investment levels. We'll talk about that. Estimate the incremental cost at each level. Evaluate the residual risk. And then do a ranking. Think of your home where you have three automobiles. And let's for argument's sake, it's a husband, a wife, and a kid. You've got three automobiles. What we would do in that situation is we would take, for example, things like the brakes and call that one package of work. Servicing, oil lube, etc. is another package of work. And maybe paint jobs is another level of work. And because the brakes would impact safety, that would get the highest ranking and priority because we would say that it would be an unacceptable risk. And therefore, no matter how much it costs, that's going to be priority number one. Something like the oil and lube, which would extend the life of the asset, would probably be number two. And something like the paint job, which would enhance the public relations reputation of the teenage kid who wants the car painted, would probably fall to the bottom of the pack, even though it's important to the teenager. So in a household, you understand how you would do it. This is what we do, because we have to make choices between servicing equipment, putting up new poles that might fall down, capital, OM&A, etc. And we have some very long-term assets. It's not just based on return on investment. If you're calculating two investment options, both with a 10% and a 15% return on equity, that's pretty easy. But if you have to decide managing assets where you spend your money, it's not as easy. So this is a little model that we put together just to help explain it. So these are the various trimming trees, lines, poles, etc. And within then, the highest risk is the red category we saw. The money has to be spent. So we spend $2, $6, $1, $9 is spent. And then we sort the others based on what we call bang for the buck. So we allocate and prioritize where for every dollar spent will reduce the risk the most. So, and then it's all put in a file, it's sorted. We have all of the where we can spend money, all the various vice presidents who are all competing for dollars. See, in most companies, what happens is the vice president with the greatest ability to persuade the CEO gets the money because he's got the greatest, he's going to make the most money, persuades everybody, and gets the money. This is far more structured because we've done the risk ranking for each type of risk, and then we've costed it out. And then we prioritize it. So this is how we spend our $1 billion a year, whether we trim trees, we put up new lines, we service our transformers and air breakers, etc. And so you could spend an hour going through this in more detail in a model, but it's just trying to get. Moving on here, these are things that I, this is an actual status report that I gave in April 2002. To the management team, and because I'm lazy, I just kind of use it in presentations. But down the left, and there are three of these slides, there are all the various things you can do in enterprise risk management. And if you read the literature and if you talk to a bunch of people that are doing this, you'll find we're all not doing quite the same thing. For example, if you have a large international company, and you have people in Australia and Hong Kong and so forth, you probably want to have local champions. We were a very decentralized company, so you'll see that's completely blank. We didn't do anything about that. In other words, when I started, I listed all the things that we might do for enterprise risk management, and then this was where we were going. You can keep massive databases, and the banks do this in operational risk to keep track of every fraud and every time a trade ticket was key punched incorrectly. So they can then do simulations and calculate the future probability of loss. Very expensive. We didn't have that kind of money, so we didn't. That's a sort of a very detailed databases to maintain. Integration with strategic planning, business planning, etc. So this was just a progress report as to how we were doing at that time. This is more of the aspects of enterprise risk management. Some companies, you'll hear them talking about keeping a risk register. Here again, it's fairly labor-intensive. It also depends the style of management of the CEO in that company. Does he want to have a very dictatorial way, or is it more empowerment down to the local unit? We only had one subsidiary called NAM that wanted to do a risk register, so we helped them set that up. And they also had to sign off every quarter that all the risks had been identified, etc. So a bit more autocratic style there, just in one subsidiary. Corporate risk profile we're doing, reporting to the leadership team and the audit and finance committee, and reporting to the board. We started at that time, and it was a month later that we did the first time. Just a summary of some of the benefits. We talked about the rating agencies looking in to see whether you're doing it or not, particularly the large corporations. Improves the communication between the board and management when you have a structured approach to do it. It reassures stakeholders that the business is being well managed. Helps meet international risk management standards. For many years, the Australian Standard 4360 has been what we've used around the community. COSO came out last 2004 with a, you know, their executive summary is the same length as the entire Australian Standard, so it's a bit cumbersome, and few people have had the patience to read the whole thing, but it's having good stuff. Allocating resources based on risk and helping to avoid surprises and ensure stability. This is a quote from our Sir Adam Beck, who started the company. We've been in business since 1906, and we have been pleasing and displeasing the public ever since. We have been cussed and discussed, boycotted and investigated, talked about, lied about, hung up, held up and robbed. The only reason we are staying in business is to see what happens next. So it's a pretty good approach to philosophy of business. I just included here a whole bunch of, if someone wants to get into enterprise risk management, this is sort of the some of the basic literature that has led us up to this point. Vernon Gross, who is a very influential guy and wrote a book in 1986 that talked about allocating capital based on risk, and it's sort of a primer, which I only became aware of a year or so ago. He was also an advisor to a previous president of the United States. That was sort of the first literature on this topic of looking at all risk in a holistic fashion. Felix Kloman, he's been publishing for about 20 years the risk management report. The Australian Standards came out in 1995 and have been updated. The Conference Board of Canada was heavily involved in the late 90s in writing literature on this topic. And then they've just published a survey in 2005 on what people are actually doing. Because what happens is you see some companies do a survey. They ask the CEO, do you have enterprise risk management? The CEO says yes. There was a survey by Pricewaterhouse a couple of years ago that said 70% of CEOs internationally said they have enterprise risk management. You do a survey and talk to the chief risk officers, and you say about 10 or 15% have it. So sometimes the CEOs think they have something maybe they don't have. James Deloach did a very good pioneering work on this topic. Unfortunately, he was with Arthur Andersen, and he published it just before Enron. And so he's still in the business, but this is a very good read on the whole science of it. And this is a book that Canadian Institute has published. This is for directors mainly, sort of 20 questions they should be asking. And this is the paper that we just wrote to get in the Morgan Stanley Journal. So, I hope it wasn't too rushed. That kind of summarized it. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, which is the fun part for me. Hi.